Support for the California Report comes from Digital Foundry, building digital capabilities for leading organizations around the world. More online at digitalfoundry.com. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we visit a soap factory in Oakland.
The women smell this soap and they go crazy. I mean, this is phenomenal, man. They smell this soap and they're like, oh my God, how did you do this?
That's just one perk for the workers at this factory, who all share a unique life experience on their resumes. And we talked to a California kayaker in Newport Beach, headed to her first Olympics at age 37.
At the end of a long day of training for you, where are you sore?
Everywhere but my eyebrows.
Plus, do-it-yourself science. Biohackers try to solve the diabetes crisis and make better vegan cheese. I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. You know how some jobs have different requirements, like
must have 5 years experience,
or
must be fluent in Mandarin?
What if one of those musts was
must have spent time in prison?
Reporter Matt Beagle takes us to a factory in Oakland to hear from workers who are entering a new and unexpected career.
When you hear the phrase all natural, organic, vegan, handcrafted soap, what comes to mind? Who do you picture making it? At Clean 360 in Oakland, it's Damian Bradley.
We have vanilla lavender, we have hypoallergenic soap, we have cotton clouds, and then we have eucalyptus lemongrass.
Clean 360 hires and trains former inmates in the art of making soap. A single bar costs $3, and 100% of the proceeds go back into the company. Bradley shows me around the single-room factory and points out the large vats of natural oils, the rows of soaps curing on the shelves.
And then here we have our additives, which is, you know, our flowers, rose petals, orange peels.
Bradley grew up in a two-parent home in East Oakland. He says even though he was encouraged to pursue his education, he started selling drugs when he was 18. For about a decade, Bradley says he was in and out of jail almost every year or two on drug charges and parole violations. With a wife and two kids, Bradley wanted to turn his life around. He looked for work at warehouses, security companies, and fast food chains.
One interview, two interview, and then, you know, once it gets to the background check, you know, it was, we'll call you.
He says just being given an opportunity here made all the difference.
They looked past my background. You know, and they actually just gave me a chance. So, you know, it was a good experience.
Bradley learned to make soap at Clean 360 and now trains newcomers in the craft.
Give me that drill.
On a recent afternoon, he works with a trainee to make a batch of kiwi banana soap. They heat oils, mix in lye, fragrance, and coloring, and pour the mixture into a cast, making a green and yellow swirl.
Just meeting, you know, guys that were, you know, in the same predicament as I was. And I mean, you know, it's wonderful, you know, to, you know, basically to give back, you know, and, you know, let guys know, you know, they still have hope, you know, in society, you know, to be productive.
The soap job is just one part of the Emancipators program, run by Akil Naji and Dr. Noha Abolada. Naji says former inmates face more challenges than the average worker. They have to adapt to life on the outside and navigate complicated systems to get services like Medicaid. Most employers, he says, aren't so understanding.
And even in the first month of this, when we bring employees on, there's a lot of adjustments going on in their lives. They have to go to work every day now. They have to adjust their schedules. And you know, so we allow for all of this. You go to the doctor, you get paid. You need to go see your probation officer, you get paid. If you go to see your parole officer, go see your parole officer, come back, you get paid.
Once employees complete the training program, which is based on personal milestones, they either earn full-time positions at Clean 360 Or, Najee says, many participants find other manufacturing jobs in Alameda County.
I never think I'll be doing this, man. I didn't think in a million years I'll be making soap, selling soap, and doing that type of stuff. But it feels good.
That's Baron Bradley, Damien's older brother, who after going through the Emancipators program, now works as a supervisor.
90% of the people that came in here have changed their lives all the way around because they have somewhere to go, somewhere to be. And they come here daily, and they're learning how to make soap, and they learn how to do something good with their mind and their hands, as opposed to doing bad things they were doing before.
Baron Bradley says the product gets rave reviews.
The women smell this soap, and they go crazy. I mean, this is phenomenal, man. They smell this soap, and they're like, oh, my God, how did you do this?
Clean 360 plans to expand, moving into a bigger factory, hiring more workers, making new products like deodorant. They're trying to secure a contract with nearby Santa Rita Jail to provide natural soap to inmates and let them know there may be a job waiting for them on the other side. For the California Report, I'm Matt Beagle in Oakland.
I realize that I can't base my vote on my LGBT views, that I have to care broader about what's good for the nation.
That's Juan Hernandez, who was in Cleveland this week to represent California at the Republican National Convention.
I believe in the Second Amendment, guns. Pretty much I believe in protection and freedom. And protection means pro-life.
He doesn't exactly fit the stereotype of a typical Trump supporter. He's a gay Latino man, and his parents are Democrats. He's just one of the people our senior editor for politics and government, Scott Schaefer, met this week at the convention. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Sasha.
Tell us a little bit about Juan Hernandez. What was this week like for him at the convention?
Well, it was exciting. It was emotional. Just a little background. He's 38 years old. He's from Santa Clara. He was a delegate for Donald Trump. And you may recall there was a very sort of violent incident at a Trump rally down in San Jose a few months ago. He was one of the people attacked at that rally. His nose was broken. And he and nine other people actually filed a lawsuit against the city of San Jose for failing to protect them. So he is a proud, as you say, Latino and gay, fourth generation American, and is, you know, sort of unapologetic about his views and feels that he's welcome and welcomed by the California Republican Party and was, you know, very excited to be there for Donald Trump.
So many California Latinos are adamantly opposed to Trump because of his stance on immigration. Why does Juan Hernandez support him?
You know, he's not alone. Latinos, especially ones who've been here for generations, whose families came here legally, I think there are some who feel that we should have laws and we should follow the laws and that people who came here illegally should not get any special privileges, that people should do it the quote-unquote the right way. You know, on my way out of the hotel this morning, I ran into a Latino couple from San Bernardino. Big Trump supporters, same thing. And they said that they take a lot of flack from their friends who are Hispanic. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, unapologetic. Like I said, they believe in what he's saying. Build the wall. That's what Juan said. Build the wall.
Juan also told you that the speech in which Trump famously called Mexicans rapists and criminals has to be taken in context.
The whole speech, you know, says that there are good people that come over here. You know, and in his word, he said, you know, there are fabulous people. We are fabulous. So he got it right.
So, Scott, you and KQED reporter Katie Orr also talked to the youngest delegate from California. Her name is Claire Chiara, and she's from Redondo Beach, but she's now a senior at UC Berkeley.
I do have friends that tease me. I also have friends that think I'm doing really great and are happy to see me out there. So on both sides, it's a lot of fun, and I never take it personally because ultimately you can't judge someone based on their political beliefs. You have to recognize they're a person that wants the best for the country just like you do.
In addition to meeting delegates, Scott, you've also been talking to Californians protesting outside of the convention.
When you know more white people were killed by police last year.
More are the excuses that they're making for all of us.
That's a statistic.
Okay,
man.
And it's
a
true.
Very weak statistic.
And Sasha, that's some video that was captured by some very young journalists who I met, Randy Villegas and Jarrett Ramones. Jarrett is from Fresno. Randy's from Bakersfield. They're both student journalists. They're part of Youth Wire, which is a statewide network of young reporters. They've been blogging and posting video online. And, you know, I was talking with them. And one of the things I said is, like, you know, you guys are young. You look young. What kind of reaction have you been getting? Have you been treated like, you know, an older journalist, somebody who is, you know, well-known? And this is what Jarrett had to say.
I feel like I've gotten just as much respect as the guy with the big camera standing next to me with, you know, the CNN logo right next to them as anyone else. Yeah.
Randy?
Yeah.
You were just saying you got into sort of an argument with a Trump guy. So tell me, what was that like for you? Did you feel like that was your role as a journalist?
To quote one of my favorite journalist inspiration, Jorge Ramos, I'm just somebody who likes to ask questions. I'm a journalist who likes to ask questions. And so when I ask this person, you know, how he justifies that policy or how he feels about it, I feel like, you know, it's our duty to report things like that and, you know, to see through the lenses, especially coming from the Central Valley where we have huge populations of undocumented immigrants.
Scott, you've been covering the convention all week for the California Report. You've put in some very long hours, and you've also gotten to witness some really historic speeches and tussles within the Republican Party. What's it been like for you personally to be at the convention?
Well, you know, we live in a bit of a bubble. When you live on the coast or you live in a big city, there isn't a lot of diversity of opinion. And one of the things I like about getting out of that bubble, whether it's to the Republican convention or even traveling to where you spent so much time in the Central Valley, Sasha, is you do get a chance to hear firsthand how people think and how strongly they hold those beliefs. You know, Juan Hernandez, LGBT, Latino, African-Americans I spoke to, some Asian-Americans as well. And it's just good to hear that, you know, there isn't a monolith out there. And we know that from polling, but sometimes we make assumptions about people in terms of, you know, based on where they live or what they look like or what their socioeconomic status is. And I think that's the great thing about being a journalist, of course, is that you get to hear directly from people and not make assumptions about them. And people are so eager and open. They want to tell you their story.
All right, Scott. Well, hope you get some rest between the conventions.
Me too. Thanks, Sasha.
Scott Schaefer is senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Next week, he's headed to the Democratic National Convention, where California Democrats will have a front row seat. How many times have you had a conversation about when they are going to find a cure for the common cold, or when they're going to make decent tasting vegan cheese? Well, what if you had a chance to discover or invent that kind of stuff yourself? That's the idea behind the trend of do-it-yourself biohacking to get regular people involved in scientific discovery. KQED's Andrew Stelzer visited a group of DIY scientists at a new crowdfunded lab in Oakland.
The lab tables in here look official, with beepers, pipettes, and fancy-looking equipment. But the walls look like an artist's studio, with huge graffiti murals.
Are you guys going to need autoclaving? Because we're ready to start the autoclave.
The autoclave is a pressurized heating chamber. Maggie Rishani, who's working on a team developing vegan cheese, offers to double up with the group extracting DNA from mushrooms.
We share everything here.
Counterculture Labs has about 35 dues-paying members and dozens of volunteers. Tamari Kurtadze has been coming here while she searches for a job in chemical engineering. She says it keeps her skills fresh and it's a chance to learn from and teach people.
If you're interested and you're willing to do something, we are welcoming to people. I've seen other hackerspaces where they require you to take certain classes before they allow you to do anything.
Looks like it's resuming, so I don't think we have to do anything else. We'll just go ahead and close the lid and call it good.
Cool.
The projects are as varied as the participants. In addition to developing vegan cheese, another group is trying to make an eco-friendly sunscreen. And the focus of tonight's weekly meeting is the Open Insulin Project.
The goal is to make and purify human insulin. And we want to do that in the simplest and least expensive way possible.
Anthony DeFranco helped start the Open Insulin Project. He's a type 1 diabetic himself, which means he needs to use insulin to balance his blood sugar. Here in the lab, he and the team are using E. coli to try and produce something biologically similar to insulin.
The first synthetic insulin was E. coli-based, and there's a whole lineage of techniques that subsequently developed.
Today, a group of volunteers is shining an ultraviolet light onto a Petri dish. If they see a green fluorescent glow, it's a protein, and it could be attached to an insulin precursor.
So the little bit of glowiness is maybe a sign that our E. coli has made the proinsulin stuff.
DeFranco knows this whole idea might not work. But whatever discoveries come out of the group work here will be open source. That means the data will be available online for anyone to use. Patrick Dozelier is a chair and a founding member of Counterculture Labs. He says the team hopes to supplement the global supply of insulin.
There's entire countries that run out of insulin for months in a row, which is essentially a death sentence for a type 1 diabetic.
A 2015 report from the World Health Organization found three-quarters of low-income countries and almost half of lower-middle-income countries did not have insulin available in the public health sector. Dozelier is a disruptor at heart. He hopes several companies will take the lab's techniques and produce more generic insulin, driving down the price all over the globe.
There's so many factors here that make this a very ambitious project.
Dr. Carl Peck teaches at UC San Francisco and was formerly the head of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research. He says he's skeptical that whatever comes of the Open Insulin Project could eventually make it to consumers. Developing and marketing a new drug can cost up to $1 billion, he says. Even a basic generic will cost tens of millions.
Think about their end goal and what the obstacles are to get there. And it's going to be money, it's going to be regulation, and it's going to be ultimately their own responsibility in developing a safe product that actually works.
The folks at Counterculture Lab say if they did get far enough to develop a product, they plan to partner with an established lab for clinical trials. And they're collaborating with another DIY lab in Sunnyvale. DeFranco says opening up the process is almost as significant as the result.
We're showing that people can do this on a very small scale, and we're documenting how that's done and sharing that information.
It may seem far-fetched, but here in the Bay Area, this is how a lot of the things that rule the world got started. And if they don't succeed at making insulin, there's always vegan cheese. For the California Report, I'm Andrew Stelzer in Oakland.
This week, new data from the California Department of Education show at least one out of every 65 kindergartners here has been diagnosed with autism. That's an increase of 17% in just 1 year. Autism is now the fastest growing disability in the state. Many parents who have an autistic child have tried some sort of unorthodox treatment, special diets, supplements, music therapy. Do any of those options actually work? KQED science reporter Leslie McClurg tried to find out.
I didn't have to look far to find a family who had experimented with unconventional treatments to help their child. In fact, a colleague of mine at KQED has a 16-year-old son with autism. His name is Leo Rosa. Leo's pacing back and forth anxiously in the kitchen of his family's home in Redwood City.
What do you want to ask for, Leo?
Leo's mom, Shannon DeRoche Rosa, hands him an electronic talker to help him communicate.
Want to eat.
More.
More.
More what, sweetheart?
Tortilla.
When Leo was a toddler, he wasn't responding when his name was called, and he didn't engage with other kids at preschool. His teachers thought he might be autistic. Shannon was heartbroken when the diagnosis was confirmed. But then she learned there might be hope in alternative treatments.
We were told
you have an autistic son, so you need to take him to these practitioners and they will help you cure autism.
Shannon saw a doctor who specializes in integrative medicine who told her that treating Leo's disorder was a matter of boosting his immune system and cleansing his body. Autism can lead to chronic issues like intestinal inflammation and anxiety. Supporters of dietary supplements say they can help improve overall health, which can reduce behaviors like tantrums, repetitive actions, or self-injuries. The doctor restricted Leo's diet and prescribed numerous supplements.
He had these like fungus supplements for if he had a fever, you were supposed to do this concoction of mycorrhizal, oh my God, like just so many things.
Shannon created a color-coded Excel chart to keep track of the pills, shots, and creams. Then Biocet was added to the mix, a combination of acupressure and muscle testing for the immune system.
You know, it's like getting your aura read, this Biocet. I mean, it's that absurd.
And did you see any improvement?
No, we didn't.
The next step was chelation, a detox therapy designed to remove heavy metals from the body. But the Roses were skeptical after digging around on the internet, so the family drew a line. The FDA now warns that chelation can lead to life-threatening mineral deficiencies. But some parents swear by natural remedies. Here's an ABC News story about a young boy named Lake from San Antonio.
Lake is being treated with a unique combination of homeopathy, chiropractic, Chinese, and Western medicine called the Nambujapad Allergy Elimination Technique, or NAET, NAET for short.
Many families choose holistic options in lieu of the traditional path, which often includes antipsychotic drugs. But the science on alternative approaches is thin, if it exists at all. Dr. Robert Hendren is a psychiatrist at UCSF who specializes in autism. He's led a handful of studies on popular options, including B12 shots, omega-3 fatty acids, and vitamin D. Hendren says the results of his small studies have shown some positive results.
It's not quite like they're cured, that they no longer have any evidence of ever having had autism, but certainly people do a lot better.
And so Hendren's continuing to look at alternative treatments, including digestive enzymes and concentrated broccoli extract. Currently, the supplement with the most evidence is melatonin. Autistic people often struggle with insomnia, so melatonin helps autism because it helps patients sleep better.
Their eyes seemed clearer, their face and interactions seemed brighter. They looked at me or at others as though they were just fully realizing that those people were there.
Despite some positive outcomes he has seen, Hendren says the science into alternative treatments is limited. For one thing, it takes a long time to track dietary changes, and the research into supplements doesn't offer the reward of a patent. Shannon Rosa is no longer experimenting with Leo's diet. In fact, she says she wishes she could go back to the moment Leo was diagnosed and give herself advice.
Your son is a great kid. He's going to be okay, and not think about trying to turn him into somebody he isn't.
Shannon says the real miracle cure is acceptance and love. For the California Report, I'm Leslie McClurg.
That's Rex. He hangs out on the docks at Newport Beach. He starts to bark when he recognizes his owner's kayak. Maggie Hogan paddles toward him at top speed.
Yeah, that's my boy. He does. He goes crazy.
Hogan was the first kayaker to qualify for the U.S. team at the Rio Olympics. She's represented the U.S. on 21 world championship teams in 5 different paddling sports, everything from dragon boat racing to canoeing. And at 37, she's headed to her first Olympic Games. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Nice to talk to you. So is the water in Newport Beach good preparation for Rio?
In Rio, it's an open lake. And we know the predominant winds come from the south, so that would be a side wind once it reaches the course. So we're expecting to be in some pretty choppy water in Rio, so I think this is probably the best place to train for that.
You know, I was recently in Rio, and I could see that the sewage sometimes flows down the mountainside directly into the ocean. Are you concerned about that?
Definitely. I've prepared for 10 years to be able to race at the Olympics. And, you know, the last thing we want is to get sick once we're there. Unfortunately, you know, we've We've had to race in dirty water before. You know, I don't bring like a water bottle in my boat. I don't drink anything when I do training sessions, and just make sure you have good hygiene and reduce our contact time as much as possible.
So I know you've actually been using some new biomonitoring technology for kayakers. How does that work?
It's basically an app on a smartphone, and it comes with two sensors, one that is taped onto your boat and the other is attached to the kayak paddle itself. So it can measure every angle, every tiny little oscillation in the boat, and it can measure how far you're going per stroke on your left side versus your right side, and it's all in real time because that information is relayed to your phone, which is in a dry pouch on the boat itself.
So you're actually watching how you're doing on your phone as you're kayaking? And you think it's helping improve your performance?
Definitely. We are in a shoestring budget because, you know, it's Michelle and I, my coach, you know, it's we're operating off of whatever we can fundraise. But we're competing against, you know, like, for example, the Great Britain Canoeing Association has a 19 million pound budget. So they have a staff of scientists that actually collect this data and crunch it for their athletes. So to be able to have this tool, and it's affordable as well, just helps us level that playing field.
Maggie, you're a little bit older than most Olympic athletes. What's it like to make your first Olympic Games at age 37?
It was definitely a dream come true. I started the sport pretty late in life. I didn't start training for it full time until I was about 26 years old. And usually, you know, around the world, kids are starting kayaking at maybe 12. I'm 37, but, you know, it's not like being a gymnast and being 37. Our sport is definitely a very technical sport, and a sport that requires a lot of strength and power and also a lot of endurance. And that's in probably the tippiest kayak in the world. It takes years to develop an athlete on all of those aspects. So I'm 37, but I'm definitely not the oldest one. In Beijing, the silver medalist for the K1 500 meters was 43 with two kids. So it's definitely possible.
At the end of a long day of training for you, where are you sore?
Everywhere but my eyebrows. No.
All right. Well, Maggie Hogan, thank you for talking with us on the California Report.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Maggie Hogan was the first sprint kayaker to qualify for the U.S. team in Rio. And that's the California Report magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Let us know what you think about the show on Facebook or calreport@kqed.org. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman. Our senior editor is Victoria Maulion. David Marks is our web producer, and our interns are Lacey Jane Roberts and Eli Wertschafter. The California Report's editorial team includes Polly Stryker, Andrea Kissick, Kat Snow, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children and youth at risk. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.